Welcome back to the weekend show, Simon Longstaff.
Thanks. You've just been anticipating a bit of disagreement about your use of that old phrase. Is that right?
That is right. Every time I do it, there's a couple of people that ring in and say, but it's a matter of explaining it, why we do it. And I hope that by doing that, then they will go, oh, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So that's not a bad place to start. I've heard you talking about the shop, and that's a really sad story, but it's not uncommon. Mm. And part of it is to do with the fact that people will not necessarily understand the position of another person. So they make all sorts of assumptions because they haven't taken the time to talk with each other to explore why a person might have a different position. They just see the position and that sets them off. But there's a deeper thing that's, I think, been largely a product of the way that social media has affected our lives and our judgment. And there's been a shift that's taken place from saying, I disagree with you and I think you're wrong, to this much broader assumption that I disagree with you and therefore you must be a bad person.
Yeah.
In other words, people have started to import all sorts of moral judgments about the character of people with whom they disagree, which colours the exchange. And so it's no longer just a disagreement about the facts of a matter or something of that kind. There's a judgment being made about the person and their motives, and that affects these conversations in a way that I think has been very damaging. But fortunately, there are ways to come back from that.
Do you think it was social media or is social media that's created this all or nothing approach?
I think it's not just that. I mean, of course, you've seen this being played out in politics with an increasing polarisation. But there's been a definite drift, and maybe it's just a correlation with the rise of social media, towards making these judgments. And it's partly to do with the way in which people start to identify themselves as belonging to a particular group. So a certain amount of what people say these days is about expressing identification with a particular group. And so it's phrased in that way to affirm your allegiance. And as you do that and you tighten the bonds of connection with one group, it becomes very easy to say, well, those who are on the outside of that group are not just wrong, but they're deficient in character in some way. They're people we can dislike. We can dismiss their views because we don't actually respect them, let alone assume that they're acting from goodwill, but just from a different position of principle.
Does that necessarily mean I then have to respect someone that holds racist views or something like that?
Well, the word respect is often used in a very general sense when it's got a couple of technical meanings. So when people like me, philosophers, talk about respect for persons, what that actually means is respecting the intrinsic dignity of the person. So it's saying that whatever their views, whatever they happen to do as a human being, there's a basic dignity that needs to be recognised and taken into account. And so we can't just dismiss them as being worthless or having no value at all, or thinking that in some fundamental sense they are lesser than us. That's a view we must hold, even though we might fundamentally disapprove of what they say. And then there's the kind of everyday respect, where people say, oh, well, you should treat me with respect, which means falsely believes that this means, oh, you've got to agree with me or not say anything which would upset me or something like that. That's not what fundamental respect is about. It's possible to respect a person and their intrinsic dignity, something that cannot be lost, even while actually going and saying, I don't agree with what you're saying, or I don't agree with what you're doing. In fact, I find the things you say, the things you believe, as being complete anathema. They really are quite appalling. But it's how you do that that becomes the secret to this. And so no one should think that to say, when people say, oh, we should disagree respectfully, we're saying you should sort of push back and not actually have a firm conversation. It's rather about don't dismiss the intrinsic dignity of that other person just because you disagree with them.
David's on the line in the Northern Beaches. You want to join the conversation, David?
Oh, yes. I believe that you attack the argument, not the person, you know?
Yeah.
Say, oh, you're a fool because, that doesn't help, right? And so that's a simple argument. Now, you might say to me, well, I used to think that way myself, but I read this book and it said that, and I learned differently. But to call, radio broadcasters, he's a fool and he's a this and that. But it's not up to us to judge people. Jesus said, "Do not judged, of course, you'll be judged. And don't call your brother a fool, because the judgment you give is the judgment you will get. So we don't want a harsh judgment when we get up there. So be kind and stick to the argument, not to the person. You know, you might even say, I can see how you've come to that conclusion, but I felt that way for a long time too. But then I learned differently when I read this book, and that has happened in free life too, hasn't it? You go, what is it? Freedom is the ability to know right from wrong, and then do what's right. I might have thought I was addicted to a certain way of thinking, and then I come to the truth and, wow, open up new horizons.
And but Anthony raises a great thing there, Simon, in that conciliatory first statement before you then go to disagree. Is that a valid idea?
Well, first of all, I want to thank him for putting it far better than I did. It's just attack the argument, don't attack the person. Or in the sporting analogy, play the ball, not the man or the person. That's the simple thing in that, and he's absolutely right to say that's the key to it. But where I would have a slightly different view from the way you just expressed it, Simon, is that I would not attack anyone as the starting point at all.
Mm.
I think the first, look, if you get into a discussion with a person where you have a different point of view, the temptation is to try and convince them immediately as to why they are wrong and you are right. And the moment you start to engage on that basis, people put up the wall. They start to defend their position. You see people arguing past each other. There's no real engagement at all. Although it sounds difficult to do, the best way to approach it is to actually begin by trying to take entirely seriously, that is to understand the perspective that the other person is putting. Even if you don't agree with it in the first place, you've got to give them space to actually at least be understood, and they should do clearly the same with you. And once that happens, then all sorts of magic begins to occur, where people start to say, well, why do I hold that? Now, because the key to doing it is, as you're speaking to someone, you say, have I understood you correctly? And you reframe their own argument. And they say, yes. And then they let go of all of that anxiety about the need to think that you're a bad person, that you don't understand, that you couldn't understand. And they open themselves up to the possibility. They say, well, why do I hold that view? Or is there an exception here? And that's when you start to see a wonderful set of developments. But you don't get there by, first of all, beginning with the process of saying they're a bad person or I've got to convince them they're wrong. You start with that common understanding.
1-300-222-702. What are your thoughts on the conversation? Join in and share it. We can also text 0467-922-702. And a great text that I guess goes to the crux of me wanting to have this discussion. And it goes, as I'm getting older, only learning other views, but as a nurse, I cannot appreciate anti-vaxxers, anti-shutdowns, anti-masks, unless they also agree not to go to hospital if they get COVID. Surely that is only fair. And this does come. You've got somebody that works at the coalface as a nurse who sees people who are, let's take anti-vax. How would you approach that?
Well, the first thing I'd say is the fact that you respect them as a human and that you might engage with them does not mean that you have to simply give way and allow them to do whatever they want. The fact is that a person who says, look, let's take the anti-vax one. Let's suppose they've got a sincerely held belief that they should not be vaccinated for whatever the reason happens to be. The mere fact that they hold that view sincerely, or that they are respected, that is, people don't mock them, they don't deride them, does not follow from that they should just be able to walk into a hospital because they have got that particular status. Instead, what you are reasonably able to do is to respect them, still disagree with them, and you are still entitled to put in prudent measures in order to protect yourself or others from the potential harm you might reasonably think that they represent. The thing to do, though, is to make sure that you don't put in measures which are in excess of what is required. So you try and aim for the least intrusive requirements for protection. But the nurse who wrote in is absolutely right to think about the protection of her colleagues, of her patients and others within the hospital system. And the person who doesn't believe in vaccination has simply no right to impose themselves upon that system just because they also claim that they wish to be respected. There's an appropriate distinction to be made there, and that's what I think the nurse is clearly relying upon.
1-300-222-702. We agree to disagree, but can we still respect each other? Simon Longstaff is with us from the Ethics Centre, ethics.org.au, and you'll find essays such as this and other philosophical reflections on the website, as well as an ethics hotline, which you can actually ring as well in these times, Simon.
Yeah, it's called Ethical, and it's been going now for over 30 years. And it's for anybody who's got an ethical issue or an ethical dilemma, and they want somewhere safe and expert to explore the options. It's not going to tell you what to do, but it's going to give you a really good structure for working through the issues and a framework for doing it beyond the extent of the call that you might have to deal with that. And you get a really diverse range of people who phone in, and in increasing numbers, clearly under the current circumstances. You just go to the website and you can book in for a call if that's something you'd like to do.
Ethics.org.au. Hi, Simon. I think there is often a confusion between disagreements and debates. A good debate with someone who is well-informed is a great learning experience. And that's, I think, coming to one of the important things is time. You need time to have a good debate.
But there's also another really interesting aspect to the comment that was just made there, and that is about learning. One of the things that you've, to have a proper debate, but I think also even a discussion, not only do you need time, but you need to be open to the possibility that your ideas may need to be adjusted. And actually, you can learn so much from people who are critical of your view. It may not actually change your view. It might actually come to confirm it by giving you new information or new reasons for holding it. But unless you're at least open to the possibility that there may be something new that allows you to adjust, then you don't get the richness that's capable of being developed out of debate. I mean, I love debates. I think the structured nature of them allows you to explore all sorts of options which you might not otherwise do, because you can actually bring to bear in a debate an element of distance where you start to say, well, let's just play with this idea. So it's very much it's a playful activity, even though the issue might be entirely serious. Conversations, discussions where the person's strongly invested in the particular point of view they hold can be a little bit difficult. But in both cases, it is about time. And that's, again, when we come back to social media, I suspect one of the things it's done is that it's required us, well, it hasn't required us, but it's sort of been built around the notion of instant opinion. So you'd like it straight away. You give a couple of words of assent or dissent, and it's all very quick without having that opportunity for proper deliberation.
You're on ABC Radio Sydney, ABC Radio across New South Wales. Simon Longstaff from the Ethics Centre, ethics.org.au, is with us.
Sarah McDonald here. Join me for evenings, Monday to Thursday from 7 p.m. We take the news in a different direction.
This has been a huge moment for a lot of scammers. They know we're on our devices more than ever because of the pandemic.
We delve deep into the minds of fascinating people.
Bowie needed a hit record, and he came to Nile Rodgers with Let's Dance, and he turned it into the big worldwide hit.
So join me for evenings on ABC Radio New South Wales.
This week on Landline, how much should wool growers be levied to fund the Australian Wool Innovation Organisation? Also, Australian farmers' growing love of chickpeas. And meet Max Bergman, a passionate camel farmer and scientist who is also legally blind.
I'm just normal. Well, I've got a disability, yeah, but so what? You know, just suck it up and deal with it.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
This is The Weekend Show, 22 minutes past 10 on this Sunday morning. Coming up, Richard Pleasance and a musical interlude. But right now, from the Ethics Centre, Dr. Simon Longstaff, we agree to disagree, but can we still respect each other, is the conversation. And I'd love to hear from you, 1300 222 702. And Ray, you're in Cobargo, beautiful part of the world.
It's a lovely part of the world. How are we?
Good. You've been listening to the conversation?
I have been, yeah. I listen most Sundays.
And what's your thoughts?
I was just interested to hear the nurse's viewpoint. If the nurse, in my opinion, her view comes from the wrong view, is that if I haven't been vaxxed and I go into hospital with a broken leg and she's been vaxxed, where's the issue of my threat to her at all about needing some hospitalisation? I'm as human as she is, and so therefore I'm entitled to be respected with my needs that I have. If I choose to not be vaxxed, I read a report 20 years ago that said, be careful of the future of vaccines and what they do for you and how well they work. Now, I look at every vaccine that comes out. I agreed with the cervical cancer vaccine, but the meningococcal vaccine didn't work. We could have had swine flu, SARS, all these vaccines that have just disappeared, the actual severity of the illness. And we have a natural immunity. So I'm choosing to not be vaxxed because I think that, I wouldn't like to get a bad dose of it. I've heard people who have had it and survived it. And just because we get COVID doesn't mean we're going to die. I think it's been really badly treated in the media and by our politicians. I see poor leadership. And so I see the viewpoints being different for how I see the world compared to how our leaders are seeing it. And I'm wondering where their viewpoints are coming from.
Simon.
Well, thanks very much for phoning in about it, because it's quite a vexed question. And I do understand your view, and it's clear that you've tried to form it based on the best research you can get. I think the complicating factor at the moment is that there are also elements in the research that are showing that unvaccinated people have a higher degree, it's a bit uncertain still about, you know, increased transmission rates, but no need to get sort of into the facts here. I think the important thing that I was trying to draw out is that the position of the nurse, which is one of concern for maybe herself, for her colleagues and for her patients, is one which means it's a relevant consideration. But I did suggest that she should only put in place measures which are strictly necessary. So, yes, if you have a broken leg or some other need for hospital treatment, clearly you've got to be in a position where emergency care can be rendered to you. But there may be additional measures that are put in place for protection. So, for example, they might need to put on additional PPE and things of that kind. Or they may say that they're going to treat you in a special section of the hospital. Or they may say a range of different things. But it's about trying to work out, firstly, whether or not the facts, as you've been investigating them, are confirmed by, you know, scientific opinion, and then looking at it as a matter of prudence as to how you manage that. The point about this conversation, though, is I don't think anyone should deride your position or mock you for holding a different view, say, to the nurse or to medical professionals. I think people should understand that you've made a real effort to try and get this, and you're not proceeding from just negativity for negativity's sake, but that you're actually basing it on investigation. But they might actually disagree with you, and they might want to sit down and say, look, this is why we think you are mistaken in this view, and this is why we want to put in these extra measures. And hopefully, and I suspect just hearing you talk, you'd be open to having that conversation and have that open mind of the possibility that they might convince you that in this case vaccination is important once the conversation had been had.
It's an interesting point, Ray. How open do you think you are at your deep gut to changing your mind?
I feel that if I wanted to travel overseas, I'm a bit disappointed that I can't even travel in my own country by the looks of things.
Yeah.
But to travel overseas, I'd then be a choice, because when we do go overseas, we've had to have different inoculations for various things. So you make a choice when you travel. But to stay in my own country and then to also be denied to possibly travel in the state or even to go to a local pub or to a concert, these threats from our leaders and dividing of the nation, I find to be pretty poor, and I think it's going to be a reflection of where we head to.
But would you be open to, I think the question Simon was asking.
Oh, that, yeah, yeah, sorry, yeah, yeah.
Would you change your mind if you've got the right evidence?
I'm looking at evidence around the countries around the world, and so far what I see is that the vaccination lasts about 6 months, and then you need a booster shot and possibly two every year. Dr. Carl was very relaxed in stating that fact the other day on Triple J, that it looks like we'll just have to line up twice a year to get a booster shot. Now, my choice to not have the vaccine is because if it was going to be guaranteed that it's going to be successful and maybe last 5 years, then I might give it consideration. But for something to last two jabs for 6 months that sit in the lymph node they've never done before, I'm sort of a little bit dubious about the long term. And this report I read 20 years ago said that we're not too sure how the continuous admission of vaccines to the body, how they'll react with each other. So these things are things that I'm prepared to see how they go, if that's what the way scientists are prepared to go and just not really trial things. But I can see that it does reduce hospitalisation. I can see the numbers in that. I look at statistics and how they go. And you can see the success rate for people who choose to have it and people who need to have it. That should be a choice, and it should be a choice that I don't have to have it. That's where it gets to in this debate of viewpoints, is that it's being made that it's not my choice, and that my choice isn't okay. And that's by
our leaders. I don't know if that's quite right.
That's the part that, well...
Can I just suggest it slightly different? I think the choice is still there. It's the implications of the choice. And so what you're being asked and others are being asked, actually everybody's being asked, is, okay, look, you may choose not to have it, but if you don't have it, there are certain conditions that will be applied that are different to those who have. And, it's like the example you gave with travelling overseas. Not everybody has to have yellow fever or whatever it was, but if you wanted to go overseas to certain countries, I had to do this myself, then you know you have to have it, and you have to have that little yellow card, as it used to be, that showed that you'd had that. If you chose not to have the vaccination, then the implication was you were also unable to do that. So I don't think we've got to the point where people are being told you must have it. It's been said you can choose not to have it, but if you don't, it's going to have consequences, implications. And that's kind of normal part of life. There's so many things where if you want to drive a car, you've got to have, you know, a license. If you want to go to a mine site, you've got to wear safety gear. If you want to be an airline pilot, you've got to have all these medical checks. It's lots of things of that kind. It's just a question of not whether people think those consequences are proportionate to the requirement.
Ray, it's interesting because you phoned in when you heard that the text from the nurse. Mark's actually a registered nurse from the North Coast. Mark, how are you?
G'day, Simon, and g'day, listeners. It's a very interesting point that you're presenting this morning. I guess from a health perspective is that when in our training as health professionals, we're not necessarily there to pick and choose about who comes in the front door when it comes to emergency departments. You know, basically someone, yes, obviously is what the previous caller was saying, you know, they've got a broken leg, you know, we've got a duty of care for that person, you know, and then we've got protocols regarding of the infection status, you know. Now, definitely that has heightened, certainly since this pandemic, but even still, you know, I've worked in environments where, you know, major city hospitals where, you know, every ward, for example, would have an isolation room for infectious diseases. So, you know, my training had over a 15-year period and even previous to that, there is always an element of someone being infectious regardless of whether it's COVID or any other infectious diseases. So that's one point I'm presenting, and the fact that, you know, I think it's unfortunate people have the mindset that they can't go to hospital because they're being ostracized because of a choice they've made. I don't believe doctors in general, health professionals do not have that attitude in regards. The other thing which I wanted to present, which I'm not necessarily saying, it's just putting it out there, is that it's subtly different, but is there potentially this debate of being conscientious objectors? But in saying that, I'm mindful, I am pro-vaccination. I'm still iffy about the mandatory thing, but unfortunately, I think it's the approach that we've been given. Like, it seems to be a top-down approach rather than a consultative, rather I think there's more of a stick and less of a carrot. Plus, I mean, yes, we didn't know what was going on, but at the same token, I mean, when you look back at the history of infectious diseases in relation to, you know, as we said, we've had corona prior to that, SARS, swine flu, bird flu, and this is always ongoing. So that information, and my final point is that as a society, I observe over my professional career as a nurse is that not a lot of people really have a lot of health literacy. So I think if they don't, that's where all these problems occur.
A few points made there. Ray's still on the line. Simon?
Yeah, well, I think Mark's making a point I was trying to make before, that in the case of the hospital, for example, it's not so much whether or not you can go or not, particularly in conditions of emergency, because the preference to render emergency aid is clear in relation to the health profession as a whole. It's that you will have a different form of treatment with different protocols around it, as was there. But they will be the minimum necessary for the health and safety of other people in the hospital, including the people who work there. And that's a really important thing to understand, that we're balancing a range of competing values and principles in this particular situation. The question about conscientious objection is a really important one, though, and that's something which is easy to trot out without understanding its history. So the role of conscience particularly in Western philosophy, is absolutely central from the time of the 13th century onwards, and particularly in the work that flows from St. Thomas Aquinas. And for people who are, say, in the Catholic Church, to this day, there is no authority, not even a Pope's authority, which has superiority to the determined, you know, the determinations of a person's informed conscience.
Wow.
But the point here is that, firstly, the conscience has to be well informed. It's not that just because you believe anything with a kind of degree of conviction that it has the status of conscience. You have to actually really know about it. So the kind of investigation, the facts matter in this, understanding the principles and all the rest. And the second thing about conscientious objection is that we've always admired it throughout human history because it's been made by people who have been prepared to accept the costs, the consequences of their conscience. People have gone to jail, for example, because of their conscientious objection to fighting in wars. People have lost their lives because of their conscientious commitment to certain beliefs and things of that kind. Now, we're not talking about that here, but I think it's one of the things we've tended to lose in the conversation is to understand that to invoke conscience is also to invoke a willingness to accept the consequences. And in the kind of cases we're talking about here, it may be that you'll be subject to additional protocols or certain restrictions about where you can travel and maybe not able to go into a particular restaurant or something of that kind. If that's a matter for you of conscience and conviction, and it's well informed, so it's not based on some kind of fantasy, then a sense of your moral conviction may be that you say, okay, I'll accept that. I understand that's the judgment that others are being made in their own interest and probably also in good conscience.
Simon Longstaff. And Ray, you've been hanging on all through that. Was that I'm hoping that was the most reasonable conversation about vaccination you've had in the past 7 days.
Yeah. I found that there was a few points there. Like, my best mate has had cancer and he's a diabetic, and I've said to him, if I was in your position, I'd probably get vaccinated.
Yeah.
So I'm not against the vaccination. I'm just what I've seen is the poor leadership we've had and the divide in the community that they've created within each other, within communities, within friendships, within relationships, because of the way the messages have been given out. And that's the part that I've taken task to, is the way that they've divided the people.
Well, look, I'm glad you actually chose to ring in and have that conversation. Simon, people can carry on looking into this at ethics.org.au. There's a great essay from you called How to Respectfully Disagree.
I look forward to the further conversation.
Simon Longstaff, ethics.org.